The 15th, or maybe the 16th year of the reign of Caesar Tiberius over Rome and its empire, late on Passover night in an upper room in Jerusalem. Jesus has washed his friends' feet, shared the Passover meal, and spoken at length. Just before the words we just listened to, he says, "Arise, let's leave." But he doesn't arise and leave. He continues speaking. We, with the 11 and probably others, listen. Judas, one of the 12, left earlier when Jesus took bread, dipped it in the dish, and gave it to him, saying, "What you are going to do, do quickly." Eavesdropping after the event, we know what the 11 don't know. This is the last evening that Jesus will spend with them before his arrest and death. His last opportunity to equip them for the horrors ahead. When, finally, Jesus and the 11 leave that upper room, they cross the Kidron Valley and enter a garden, where Judas comes and greets Jesus with a kiss. That's later. Now Jesus is speaking. The analogy of the vine and the branches is familiar to us. Listening all these centuries in retrospect, the meaning seems clear. First, to remain vital in our faith, we must remain closely connected with Jesus, learning from and growing in him and inviting the Spirit to flow through us. Second, we expect and trust God to prune us, to cut off parts of our individual and collective lives. Pruning hurts, but it's important. The things God prunes may not be bad in themselves. They may be good with loads of potential, but if they distract and divert us from the mission to which the Spirit calls us now, they have to go. It seems simple. But Jesus says more than this to his disciples that night and to us now. Remember, all those sharing that Passover meal were first century Jews. They probably couldn't all read, but they did all know their scriptures, our Old Testament. They knew that the vine is a picture, a symbol for God's covenant people, ancient Israel at that time. As we heard the psalmist pray earlier, and hopefully we prayed with him, "You, God, brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land." Perhaps better known is a parable told by the prophet Isaiah. God plants and carefully tends a vineyard, only to be disappointed when it does not yield the fruit that God expects. Later in the book of his prophecies, Isaiah anticipates that day, a time to come in which the vine would make peace with God, take root, blossom, put forth shoots, and fill the whole world with good fruit. As I was rereading this section of Isaiah during the week, I thought again of what's happening in other parts of the world, particularly the Middle East, and how God's election, God's choice, God's calling is always contingent. And the type of fruit that we bear shows whether we are living as God's people or not. Other biblical prophets use similar imagery for the people of God. Beyond the Bible too, later Jewish separatist movements minted coins depicting a vine to declare their freedom. Both during the Jewish War, the war in which the temple was destroyed, and nearly a century later, during the short-lived Bar Kokhba revolt. So, when Jesus says, "I am the true vine," he both uses a metaphor that helps us understand how closely he longs to relate with us, a mutual indwelling and inliving, and he declares that he is the true Israel, the true people who will fill the whole world with the fruit of justice and righteousness. Jesus is the one on whom God's purposes now rest, and in whom we now become God's people, called to fill the world with good fruit. And we will, as long as we abide, as long as we remain deeply rooted in him. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in them, they bear much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, they are thrown away like a branch and wither. And the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. If you abide in me, and if my words abide in you, whatever you wish, it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. What is the fruit that Jesus wants us to bear? Listening 2,000 years later, we all too easily jump to love, peace, joy, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. The fruit of the Spirit that Paul lists in Galatians and elsewhere. We certainly should bear this fruit. But were these particular virtues what Jesus had in mind when speaking with his friends in the upper room in Jerusalem after sharing that last Passover meal together? And on that evening, Jesus has not yet died, let alone risen. Paul has not yet met the risen Christ, much less written to encourage the early believers gathered in Galatia or anywhere else. Remember Isaiah. God looked for justice, but behold bloodshed. God looked for righteousness, but behold a cry. And later, the vision of that day on which the vineyard would finally live up to its calling, making peace with God and filling the whole earth with good fruit, justice and righteousness. Jesus does not command his friends to bear fruit. He commands them to abide in him and to love, but he assures them that they will bear fruit when they abide in him. Marianne Thompson puts it this way: the life of Jesus flows through the lives of his disciples in the midst of the life of the world. The life and fruitfulness of the branches depends upon the life-giving power of the vine. We do not become Jesus' disciples by bearing fruit. The fruit we bear, the good grapes of justice and righteousness, or the wild grapes of bloodshed and violence, this fruit demonstrates whether we are following Jesus, whether we are his friends or not. When we abide in Christ, when we are pruned by God and invite the Spirit to flow through us, we will produce fruit that glorifies God. Jesus continues, "As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy might be in you and that your joy might be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down their life for their friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves, for a slave does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You didn't choose me. I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you so that you will love one another. Listening to Jesus' words, do they remind you of other words? Something, perhaps, that you've heard in the Old Testament? If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. This is my commandment. You are my friends if you do what I command you. You didn't choose me, I chose you. These things I command you. All this language of abiding or dwelling, of command and commandment, of love, echo the language of many Old Testament covenant passages. Listen, for example, to the beginning of Leviticus 26. I am the Lord your God. If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will bless you. I will make my dwelling among you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. And listen to Deuteronomy 7:9. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandment. In the ancient world, kings and other power holders often used covenants to order their domestic and external relations. But biblical covenants, covenants that God makes, are distinctive, because God initiates God's covenants with entire people, not just those at the top, their rulers. And God's covenants serve radically different purposes. They are always about love, about call, vocation, promise, and command. They give identity, purpose, and hope. They tell people who they are, how they relate to the world, and what they, as a people, collectively are called to do. In Deuteronomy 7, for example, Moses explains that God set God's love on ancient Israel and chose her. That God keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love God and keep God's commandments. That God blesses those God calls in order that they might be a blessing, showing the nations the way of Yahweh by keeping God's commands, by doing righteousness, mercy, and justice. God's covenants and Jesus' new covenant call God's people to live together in ways that reflect God's character, embodying and enacting the love of God and thereby creating communities and societies in which all people are welcome and all people enjoy fullness of life. If we had read back earlier in this long scene in John's Gospel, we would have heard Jesus use that same language of love and command again and again. The passage we sang, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. If you love me, you will keep my commandments." They who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me. We expect Jesus to use love language, yet somehow forget that this language comes straight from his Bible, our Old Testament. Jesus here establishes a covenant with his friends, reminding them of their identity and vocation, chosen and appointed, called by him, loved by him. He commands them to love. Love of God, neighbour, enemy alike. A new covenant with a similar purpose to the old. God's covenant with Noah was intended to bless all of creation. God's covenant with Abram and his descendants was intended to bless all peoples. God's covenant with ancient Israel through Moses was intended to bless all nations. And now, Jesus' covenant with his friends is intended to bless the whole world, the cosmos. So, what does it mean to be a friend of Jesus? In the Old Testament, only one, or possibly two, people are described as friends of God: Abraham and possibly Moses. These two, Abraham and Moses, struggled, even argued with God. They engaged with God robustly. And now at this Passover meal, Jesus extends the immense privilege of friendship with God to the 12, and then we believe to all who abide in him through later generations. What does it mean to be Jesus' friends? First, to abide in him. To deeply, robustly engage with Jesus in all dimensions of our life, our inner life and our outer life, keeping the command, the covenant of love. Abiding, or obeying commandments too, these are not passive, disempowering things. Keeping the command of love does not mean gritting our teeth to think and act robotically, unthinking about what we do, or thinking that we've been told to do something and just going about it mindlessly. Covenant keeping is robust and vigorous. Sometimes it will involve resting in God's love. Sometimes it involves struggling, wrestling, arguing, even fighting with God. Abiding can be painful. It involves divine pruning. As God prunes us, we let go of things, often good things that hold us back from following where the Spirit leads. This means choosing not to do many good things that we could do, but would lead us away from the calling of God. If we love Jesus, we keep Jesus' commands. When we keep his commands, we embody and enact love, inwardly in our hearts and outwardly in all aspects of our individual and collective lives. We embody and enact love by befriending each other, living together as a covenantal community, sharing our joys and sorrows, supporting each other in time of need, challenging, convicting, even rebuking when necessary, and always in love and with gentleness and humility. When we live together as a covenantal community, we will be living together toward the world of God's promise, a world with God's will done and God's kingdom come on earth as in heaven. So we embody and enact love by befriending the world, being the branches of the true vine that one day will fill the world with the good fruit that God expects. How do we bear the fruit of justice and righteousness? By allowing the life of Jesus to flow through us, to flow through our lives, through our interactions with other people, through our professional and work lives, through our giving, spending, and investment choices, and, dare I say it, through our political commitments and actions. As Jesus' friends, we share his sorrows and we share his joys. We also share his vision and his commitment. We make his priorities our own, his mission our mission. In other words, as we live in him, we live for him.